Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery.
3119 Twin View Boulevard.
Hold on now.
Sorry.
Now, just hold on. You're walking all over my ad here. Pape Machinery is our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And if you need a mower, a tractor, implements, parts, service, they do it all up there. Go up and see them. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. Thank you.
That was my part.
Thanks, Aaron. And or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. And they also still have a few Honda generators if you're looking for a generator for standby power. And they have a pretty good inventory of steel products. So go up and see them.
Yeah, hurry up before they get rid of all the gas-powered everything in California.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's going to work out well. Hey, so on a serious note, there was a post on Facebook, which usually is like, oh, okay, I couldn't care less. But someone sent this to me, and I thought, you know, this really should be shared because there's a lot of, well, okay, I think in the scope of news these days, it's 99% bad. I think that's what news is. It's like bad news. This was really a different little look at the fire up there in Greenville. So I don't know who the guy was, but he says, to say going back to Greenville for the first time was difficult would be an insult to my hometown. It was soul-shattering, life-changing. And as I looked over the land where my town once stood, I felt the little bit of hope that I'd been holding on to slowly fade away. I'm one of the lucky few. My home is still standing. Somehow, despite the odds, I was able to walk through my front door this week. And as I did, I found this letter. A letter from one of the firefighters, the brave firefighters, who risked their life that night. I knew they had replaced my flag, but reading this restored some of my hope. Hope for our nation and hope for our community. And I'd like to share it with you all. The note said, "Dear homeowner, my name is Jay, and I'm an operations branch director for the California Federal Incident Management Team 4. On the evening of August 4th, as the Dixie Fire came through the town of Greenville, I was leading firefighting forces that had responded in an attempt to save as many structures as we could. Fire conditions were extreme, to say the least, and the environment that we were operating in was equally hazardous. When we arrived in your neighborhood, the fire conditions had created 65-mile-an-hour winds and a large ember storm. The fire was well established around the homes, and the conditions were deteriorating rapidly. As crews and myself fought to push the fire back off the homes, I observed through all the embers the wind, your flag flying stoically against the destruction unfolding around us. Your flag served as a morale booster for so many of the brave men and women out here working to save your homes. Many of those men and women were military veterans that had served our country prior to becoming firefighters, and for them the flag had additional significance. Around 20-45 hours, fire behavior escalated to an unprecedented level with yet another ember storm and 60 to 70 mile an hour winds. While we held our ground, it was at that point that I retrieved your colors rather than allowing them to be destroyed. For 2 days, your flag rode with me, folded and safely protected in my command vehicle as conditions were still extremely fragile. I wanted your return to your home that is still standing to be emphasized by a new flag that is still standing and flying proudly. I hope that this new flag can symbolize the pride and strength of your community and the determination and resilience of our firefighters. I also wanted your old flag that you flew so proudly in front of your home and over your community and our great country to honor Greenville and the horrible tragedy and hardship that it has endured. My team and I would like the nation to know the pride and strength of Greenville and its residents like yourself who live there. It is because of that your flag is on its way to Washington, D.C. to be flown over the U.S. Capitol building in honor and respect of your community and the strength and resilience of Greenville and our great nation. Your old flag is not mine to take. It belongs to you, and it will be returned to you. For now, I want your colors to continue to fly proudly over Greenville, California, and American soil. Please feel free to contact me or a liaison officer with any questions or concerns. Thank you for your patriotism to our country and for giving all of us out here that night, fighting to save everything we could, a symbol and colors to fight under. Yours respectfully, Jay, OPS Branch 25.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It also, there was also like a little P.S. The flag we're flying once belonged to my grandfather. It's a flag that flew in front of his old home for years. He was a 30-year Air Force veteran and proud American. It was pretty, can you imagine you come home, your house isn't burned down? That's pretty great, but your town's gone, and then you find that note. It's like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Tanya.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I'm a little choked up.
Yeah. It's like, okay. Now, back to the world. But I thought, gosh, I don't want to run out of time and not share that, because that says a lot. It says a lot about the people in Greenville. It says a lot about how people felt about trying to save it. And sometimes these things look really mechanical, you know. Oh, great, it's a fire. Here come the firemen, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Everybody just goes through the paces. And it's not really like that. It's much more, there's a lot more emotion than that involved for the people who live there, the people that are trying to save the place and everything else. So I think it's...
As we drove up the hill to the house that I grew up in, which is like the person who posted that, we were extremely fortunate that it survived. The flag is still flying there. And as we sat on the front porch, there's one young doe that just has been hanging out on the front lawn, and there's one fire truck still sitting up there covered in pink fire retardant that this little deer keeps hanging out by the fire truck. And we finally all figured that perhaps the firemen were feeding her.
Oh.
Because she's not scared of us, and we're so far out of town. So that little doe is now named Dixie, and we just watch her every day in amazement.
Well, the other thing too is I'm sure she figured, you know, it was kind of like magical. There was no fire by the red trucks.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, you know, follow the red trucks.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty. That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Well, us and the other people who were fortunate, everybody is, you know, ready to open hearts and homes and water systems and whatever is needed to help the community come back. You know, we've got to keep fighting to make sure it stays local, though. That's a really important one for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want to go now?
I don't know. There, I feel like
concrete doesn't seem very in the face of all that. Although I will say, all
but
right,
it, but so it is because all those things don't get saved without folks like you who understand how.
Right.
I mean. Pearl Harbor, Alcatraz. I mean, honestly, I remember years ago because I started going to Alcatraz with, you know, relatives who moved out here or came out to visit when we moved out here. And, you know, let's go to Alcatraz. It was like, oh, Aaron could take them. Great.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot better. Bill had never been, even though he lived down there for a long time. And when did we go to Alcatraz? It's been like maybe 15 years ago. But it was looking really hammered. Like in the early 80s, it's looking a lot better, you know, in recent years. And it sounds like, how long have you been working on that? How long has that project been ongoing?
I started down there just in the summertime in 2010. And we have been, that was just an informal program I started. And then it became a year round in about 2014. We've been there year round. We do three teams a year, 12-week teams each year, you know, of military people. So I think you mentioned it earlier. If someone listening has a service member getting out and would like to do some training, you know, the construction industry, we work to get them their jobs, but it's not just, you know, being on a construction crew or mixing concrete in a plant. They're, you know, the construction is such a major part of the United States economy. They need drivers. They need scientists. They need accountants. They need, you know, front office workers. They, you know, it's an enormous industry, so it's not just.
Yeah, you guys aren't just kind of like a fancy day labor force. I mean, you're
no,
helping people actually find real careers. And
right, our primary focus is the military service member. We do projects and parks as the training, but our and another thing that we do, and I think we touched on this earlier, we do not. The service members who do our program do not have to touch their GI Bill benefits. That's a core value to this nonprofit foundation is they get to maintain their GI Bill benefits for use once they get out in some other training, and they can actually now transfer them to their spouse or children.
Oh, that's awesome.
So if, yeah, so if that service member, you know, does a program like this and lands in a job that they love and doesn't need it, they can pass that on forward. So we rely
yet,
a lot
yet
on
again
that.
You've sidestepped the bureaucracy. Good thinking.
Yes, exactly.
Good thinking, because, exactly. You know, trying to get those benefits lined up with what it is that you're doing and what they want to do. Yeah, private industry just is so much more nimble. It's so much easier to be responsive.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you were talking about, you know, how Concrete looked at Alcatraz, and one thing that Concrete is a kind of a blessing and a curse is that it is so durable for so long, but unlike wood and other building materials that may show their distress sooner on the exterior, most of, and this might get a little into the science and technology of it, but it's kind of fascinating stuff. What most of us see as deteriorating concrete, by the time we see it, it's much worse inside of the structure. Mm. And it's essentially not the concrete that's failing, it's the steel reinforcing.
Oh.
So.
Well, that's funny you say that, because I think that's exactly what they're finding in Florida with that big condo collapse, that it had
absolutely
completely decayed on the inside.
Absolutely. There is so much technology now for being able to assess all of that. It's just like any of the infrastructure across the U.S. You need to invest in routine maintenance and investigation to know the condition. I mean, there's ultrasonic pulse velocity and all kinds of technologies that can see right inside of concrete, so that you know what's going on inside.
And how much of that do you think actually goes on with a lot of our infrastructure, bridges and so forth?
Very little, because if you're the taxpayer, you want to see the new road go in. You don't want to see the old one fixed.
Right.
You know, it's a battle, right? So if you think about, here's a way to envision what's going on. We're still making concrete essentially the same way the Romans did. Sand, cement, rocks, and water. You know, it's not really that much more complicated, other than present day, we add a lot of chemical admixtures to make it be high strength, lightweight, perform well in freeze-thaw environments or in salty environments by the ocean. The chemicals are added to make it do those things.
Is it true they actually add fiberglass to concrete in places?
Everything is added, you know, for different reasons.
It's like hot fly dogs.
Fly ash, which is a byproduct of this, you know, of coal burning, coal industry is used, and it increases long-term strength of concrete. Slag, which is a byproduct of the steel industry, is used for the same reason. If you go back and look at the great example is the Pantheon in Rome. The walls at the base of the Pantheon's concrete, 2,000 years old, are 20 feet thick.
Wow.
And today we build things that are taller or longer span that are a foot thick. The difference is reinforcing.
Mm-hmm.
So the Romans actually understood the performance of concrete enough to know that they needed some kind of reinforcing. So think about it this way. If you have a big, tall concrete column, you could put something extremely heavy on top of it, and it's not going to crush the concrete. And here's a good visualization of that. If you took one square inch of concrete, a little tiny 1-inch by 1-inch by 1-inch cube, and you put a Suburban, you know, a GMC or Chevrolet Suburban, on that one little square inch, it wouldn't crush it. That's the compressive strength of concrete. If you took that same, if you took a big long column and put it on its side and put each end on top of a post, it doesn't do as well in that situation. And that's because concrete can more easily be pulled apart than it can be pushed together.
Compressed.
So the Romans realized that if we want to build really tall walls, they can't be really thin, because if the wind hits it, they're not going to survive. So they just built them massively thick. They actually tried to reinforce their concrete with bronze, which was the metal technology they had. But as it turned out, bronze and concrete had different rates of expansion and contraction, which cracked the concrete. So they understood the need for reinforcing 2,000 years ago, but didn't have the technology to do it.
That's
so today,
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And
it
then,
is amazing.
Like, you look at the Appian Way, and that's rock. I don't know if they mix it with concrete. I'd be curious what you think about that, because actually the Appian Way, driving on that, was like the smoothest road ever. And I mean, the Romans made that. Like,
yeah.
Maybe they could
come for chariots.
Maybe they could come to work for Caltrans.
Yeah.
She does work with Caltrans too, by the way. I read about that. We'll be right back and learn about that. Maybe you can tell us a little about that too and how that works. I know up here too, we're changing some of our, especially in the areas that have heavier snow load up by Mount Shasta and in the canyon up there, they are replacing the asphalt roadways with a concrete highway. So I think they're looking at, gosh, it's fun fixing these every year, but maybe we could just do something really good that lasts for a long time.
Yeah.
Clever idea. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Tell you what you do. Call them a rain. Some douchebag rises up and overthrows his government. Diplomacy ain't working. And ammo's all been spent. The world is in a crisis, and the media's a curse. I'll tell you what to do when it goes from bad to worse. Call a Marine, instead of 911. They're built to improvise, adapt, and overcome. When you're in knee deep and you're up shit's creek, you've tried everything. Tell you what you do. Call a Marine. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. And you'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. All brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Okay, so my hope is that every radio station in the country just starts playing that song endlessly, and then accidentally someone at the White House hears it and feels motivated by it. Enough said.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Yep, there you go. And we'll end it there. We could also play that for the State Department. I've got several departments I'd like to play it for. None of the guys you work with, though, you know, no Caltrans, no national parks, they're all good. We won't get you in any trouble. But you do consulting work with all of these different people, too. It isn't just historic preservation that you do, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not. In fact, that's just it's really how I ended up coming into the concrete world. You know, repair is not just about historic buildings. It's about, you know, all the infrastructure and that kind of thing. And most of the work I've done has involved, I've always had a training focus along with what I do. So it's either with college students or with the people training from the military and our foundation that have done different projects. One that we did that was fascinating, and I'm hoping that somewhere down the road it picks back up. With this is again another tangent, but it's quite interesting. In NASA's space program, they have technology to convert the CO2 that astronauts breathe out to usable oxygen on a spaceship. NASA, as a federal agency, has to prove when they go to Congress for their funding that there is an Earth application. It's easier for them to get funding for research if they can show that it has, you know, that the rest of us get to benefit somehow other than, wow, it's great that we're going to outer space. Well, NASA identified the concrete industry, specifically the cement industry. So concrete and cement, not the same thing, right? Cement is the gray powder that goes in and mixes with sand, rocks, and water to make concrete. Mm-hmm. But NASA identified the cement industry as a good partner, mainly because of the CO2 produced in the manufacture of cement. 5% of the world's CO2 is a factor of cement production worldwide.
No kidding.
Now, everybody loves to scream about, well, concrete's bad then. Concrete's bad. We need to use asphalt, which is really beneficial to the big oil companies. And we can't use concrete, though. Well, let me give you the facts on that. If half of that 5% is the power needed to heat cement that creates the cement process, the other is a chemical reaction. When you take a limestone rock, you crush it, burn it, and go through the steps, it comes out the other end of a kiln as cement. But cement is only roughly 11%, give or take, of a mix of concrete. Uh-huh. The rest is local sand, rocks, and water, typically. When you look at the sort of cradle-to-grave life cycle of that, concrete is a very sustainable material for how long it lasts, the big percentage of the rest of the materials that are local. So, you know, you'll often hear arguments that cement is terrible, and we all envision all of the big concrete that we see out there having produced CO2, and that's not the case. It's only the gray powder part. So it is actually in the overall view a very durable product and one of the best taken as a whole for, you know, CO2 levels, if that's your interest.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're always debunking something. Never fails. We're told all sorts of, you know, just ludicrous lies that, and you know, well, look at the fires. Look at forest fires. I was thinking about that a couple of weeks ago, and I realized, you know, we talk about tornadoes and hurricanes and all these things as natural disasters. Fire, natural disaster. It's like no, mostly an engineered disaster. We've done that one on purpose. And if we allow that to become a natural disaster because of climate change, because that's what they want it to be, it's all caused by climate change. So if everybody gets out of their car, nothing will burn down again. It's like,
right.
Yeah, okay. Well,
that's a management plan.
That's why I played Ray's show again. We did that show in October, and I think I played it in February, and I played it again a couple weeks ago because, honestly, we just can't let people be dumb about this stuff. So do the thing.
Right.
Okay, so someone says, well, concrete's bad for the environment. It creates a bunch of CO2. What's our answer again?
Concrete doesn't create CO2. Cement production does. But it's such a small part of concrete. And it is so durable and lasts so long that the percentage, I'm not giving you a very good elevator speech for that.
No, it's pretty good.
Taken in a nutshell, the long-term durability of concrete, the small percentage of concrete that is the cement portion, which is the only part that produces CO2, it is an extremely environmentally friendly solution.
See, that's easy.
The only solution otherwise is just don't build anything.
Right? Yeah, right.
You know, we're not over our national obsession with building stuff, so... You know, and you mentioned the roads being, you know, over Lake Tahoe, Interstate 80 over Tahoe is also, over Donner Pass has also been redone in concrete.
Oh.
And, you know, the reason for that, and like you mentioned in your area, is it's just so much more durable.
Well, they have the plows.
Heavy truck traffic with
yeah, they've got all the plows, the they've got all this stuff, and, you know, the asphalt is just, it's funny because I grew up in Connecticut, and we did a lot of shoveling because... You know, we were the Irish Catholic kids, so we didn't have snowblowers. We had shovels. I think that's why our parents had so many children. That was the rumor anyway. How's your kid with a shovel? Pretty good. But we did – there was this one lady, Mrs. Fetterhoff, and Mrs. Fetterhoff's driveway was asphalt. She was the only one with an asphalt driveway, and it went to – her garage was in the back of her place. And that asphalt driveway was like a puzzle. So every winter you had to go shovel Mrs. Fetterhoff's puzzle. And if you got too close to the pieces of the puzzle, they chipped out and you had to get them all fit back in there because it was asphalt.
Yeah, asphalt is not
the concrete
permanent.
Driveways were like, whoosh, 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 you know, and you were done.
Right.
It was a million % better.
Yeah. Well, and then on top of that, you know, every industry hopefully is innovative. And you know, the concrete industry, you know, we touched on the idea that it's the typically – the steel reinforcing inside the concrete that starts to rust or technically corrode. And when that reinforcing inside of the concrete that's there to make it withstand lateral forces and tension and all these other things, otherwise it would have had to be 20 feet thick, when that steel starts to corrode, it expands, and that starts to crack the concrete from the inside. So by the time you're seeing the spalling and the little rust marks on the corners, especially of concrete structures, chunks start to fall off, and then more moisture gets in and causes more corrosion. You know, for instance, glass fiber reinforced concrete is now a new solution. We use that on historic buildings. We're using it. It's fairly new in the industry, but you can substitute steel reinforcing with glass fiber reinforced or other systems that include fibers, so tiny little fibers all mixed throughout the concrete matrix. So there's a lot of innovation going on that will take the steel corrosion and even ways to use steel and keep it from corroding. So it's really not that concrete is deteriorating in our infrastructure across the country. It's you know, sometimes it's the workmanship of when it went in. Sometimes it's not designed well to begin with. Most often it's steel corrosion that causes the damage, but there's a lot of innovation going on around solving that. And I would also mention, this is at all fascinating to people out there and you have kids looking at college, Chico State has one of the only 5 university majors in concrete. It's called Concrete Industry Management, or CIM. Like I said, it's a technical degree along with a business degree with heavy support from the industry. And I would definitely encourage, if you have, you know, kids looking at college in that region, it's Chico State was chosen for this program to represent the West Coast by the industry. And really, there's a lot of reasons for that. One is, you know, the industry was really interested in state school, hardworking, you know, a little more interested in application than you know, the big R1 research theory-based universities. So it's a very, very high success rate in job placement, job retention, and it's pretty awesome for a college student to go and get a degree that is so applicable and so connected with the industry.
Yeah, since a lot of them are, you know, I mean, not really all that helpful. I won't name any. I had some in mind. Lesbian studies.
Well,
but anyway, that was just,
we could go into that. I taught at university for 10 years and that was enough.
Yeah, so you know all about the degrees that really weren't all that helpful.
Well, you know, there's a lot of battles. You know, I think there's a lot of good arguments on either side, but there were those in academia who argued that something disapplicable didn't belong in a university.
Oh, you're kidding.
And, oh, I fought some major battles there on that front. One of my responses, we're housed in the College of Engineering, and one of my responses was, well, our students are getting jobs paid more than a lot of the engineers are getting, and they're getting promoted faster. They're managing the projects that your engineers are working for. Not that engineering is a bad field. They're both very good. But, you know, it's a highly technical, highly business-oriented. It's a huge shaker and mover and shaker in the U.S. economy. So it's, you know, it's going strong. I would encourage people to check it out.
That's really cool.
Wow, that is.
Tell me this. What about what about dams? I mean, because we, you know, I fight a lot about the removal of the dams up on the Klamath, and excuse me, they're, you know, the other side. How about that? My sister says I'm a name caller, so you know, I guess I'm finding myself editing what I say. It's really. I have these long pauses with myself.
I was gonna say that.
Okay, the haters who are stupid and just, you know, will say things like, "Well, these dams are all antiquated and they have to come out." And I've read more than one place, if you can verify for me, that these huge concrete dams take like 100 years to cure.
There's a lot of interesting ways that is managed. You know, if you look at the Grand Coulee or the Hoover Dam are two of the biggest. The way that those, yes.
I mean, it takes a really long time, so just because they're old doesn't necessarily make them antiquated.
No, certainly not. And they can be added on to and you know, upgraded you know, concrete's a great, you know, I hate to use the word flexible with concrete, but where it can, you know, let me get back to your question about 100 years to cure. Theoretically, concrete never stops curing.
Oh.
Theoretically.
Okay.
You could find some cement grains within, you know, any concrete structure that never came in contact with water. So imagine if you take dirt off the ground and mix it with water, you get a mud paste, right? And when that, really the water's just evaporating out eventually, and then you end up with crumbly dirt again. Cement works very, very differently than that. The way cement is made, you take limestone rocks, which are calcium carbonate, used to be at the bottoms of oceans, seashells.
Mm-hmm.
So you take calcium carbonate rocks, which is limestone, they crush them up, put them through a massive kiln. Even a small one is about the length of a football field, and it's on a tilt. It's a big round cylinder in these rocks, and this go tumbling down through. They get heated to 2,700 degrees, and that's where CO2 is lifted off, and these little rocks come out the other end of the kiln called clinker. They look like little black balls. And then those get ground up, and that is what we know of as cement. It's also mixed with gypsum and other things. So cement is the gray powder of cement. When you mix that with water, it's not just water getting mixed in and then drying out. When water hits a cement grain, it undergoes a chemical reaction. And that is what produces its strength.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that you can keep the water in the concrete, like you might have seen somebody sprinkling a sidewalk with water after they've placed it down, or putting plastic over it. The whole point there is to not let the water evaporate. You want the water to react with the cement grains that produces the strength. Well, theoretically in a lab, every grain of cement has hit some water and is a part of that structure. In the real world, you know, we don't have the perfect mixing technology to really make that happen. So if you have, you know, a dam, a massive concrete dam, concrete at the center of that dam is going to take a very, very, very long time to go through its complete reaction, because there's also heat given off, and if it's trapped deep inside, the heat can't be given off. But the fact that it hasn't cured completely 100 years later has nothing to do with the strength. They reach the strength within however long they were engineered to early on in their construction.
Sure.
But it's kind of an interesting sequence of events. And another kind of cool way to think about this is, so we took limestone rocks, we burned them, released CO2 into the atmosphere, not that much in the grand scheme, and then we mixed that cement with sand, rocks, and water, and we created a concrete dam. Nature has this really funny, over time, concrete wants to reabsorb CO2.
Oh.
And turn back into limestone. It's a natural process. Now, it's not that concrete is the solution to a CO2 problem, because it can't absorb that much that fast.
That's provided we think there's a CO2 problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, we should probably add that in.
But there have been those, you know, early on when that realization was really, hey, we can, you know, concrete the solution, and it's really not. But I bring that up because I like, you know, it's man-made stone.
Yeah.
That's what we're creating with concrete.
And does that absorption of the CO2, does that make the concrete harder?
It does, but it also, it's a complicated reaction, because if there is steel reinforcing, it can actually accelerate, it's called carbonation. Hmm. It's reabsorbing CO2. It, depending on the concrete mix and the circumstances, it does add a little bit of strength, but it can also cause other issues, like it can make the steel reinforcing corrode faster. There's a lot of steps in there I'm not going through, but carbonation in an unreinforced structure is not necessarily a bad thing.
Hmm. Wow.
Carbonation in a structure that has steel reinforcing is a contributing factor, or can be, depending on other circumstances.
Doesn't that give us all a little bit of
some,
a few extra tools in our tool shed There's nothing, well, you know, like there's nothing like it. You know, they come after you with this stuff, and it's like, oh, man, I never thought about that. I don't know.
Right.
You know, and this is one of those, like, now we're always smarter. Right. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Wattenberg-Comas. We're talking about all sorts of things we never talk about. I really hope you send this show out to your friends and stuff. I think it's pretty interesting, and I am always thrilled when we find somebody who's talking about something that isn't already, that we didn't already get bludgeoned with all week. Yay! Something new to expand our minds. So let's see, today is August 29th, 2021, and you'll be able to find this show commercial-free this afternoon, a little bit later on, at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's the guts and it's the glory, 100 stripes, 100 stories. It's the Pledge of Allegiance on the 4th of July. It's them handwritten letters from home. It's them sleepless nights alone. It's his newborn baby he left with his wife. Mr. Red, White, and Blue, lay down his life. Mr. Red, White, and Blue, for these stars and stripes. Hey.
I'm a chicken fried, a cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right, and a radio. Well, I was raised up beneath the shade of a Georgia pine, and that's home, you know. Sweet tea, pecan pie, homemade wine, where the peaches grow. In my house, it's not much to talk about, but it's filled with love that's grown in southern ground. And a little bit of chicken fried, cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right.
Good one. Travis was inspired. He's like, can we play that one? Like, I don't have it. I'll find it. Kudos to you. That was fun. Oh, so
so we were talking about the CO2 factor on concrete. That was very interesting.
I love that. That's very okay. That goes right behind. If CO2 is a pollutant and we're breathing it at 400 parts per million in ambient air, and then we do CPR on somebody and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation actually puts 40,000 parts per million into them if you blow into somebody. So why didn't they all die?
That's a head-scratcher.
That's a toughie.
Stop! You're killing them!
Said no one ever.
Well, you know, I will add something that's another interesting concrete fact, which is, so because of CO2 production, it's very hard to get a permit to create cement in the United States.
Oh, really?
Existing plants have had to meet new standards, but a lot of smaller ones have closed down, and a lot of it's now being produced in China with no regulations. And then we ship it all back over here because, you know, again, we either need to give up our habit of building a lot of new stuff or figure out better ways to do it, but just saying not in my backyard is not a solution,
no.
Right?
We have a plant just north of us. What?
Yes.
5 miles?
Yeah, I've been to that plant many times.
Mm-hmm.
The Lehigh
yep.
plant.
We love them. Calaveras Cement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three cheers for Calaveras Cement.
They're a supporter of the CIM program at Chico State, and also I know a lot of those guys, and that, you know, we've had field trips with our military people in my nonprofit program. They're a good company. If we're still going to build things, and we still want to build them out of concrete, there are ways that we can be doing it better right here at home. But, you know, like I said, as long as we're just closing our eyes to the fact that, well, it's all being created in China, and then we have all the CO2 to ship it over here and put it on trucks and beat up the highways, and, you know, are we really solving the problem? Why aren't we just letting those jobs be right here in the United States?
Yeah, no kidding.
And where we have control over quality and you know, local economic development around those kinds of things. And I think that goes right back to, and, you know, maybe this is the last 10 minutes or so, is, you know, coming right back to a local community like Greenville or any other small town or somewhere that's trying to build, rebuild, or just continue to build. The concrete's a great solution. It survives fires, hurricanes, those kinds of things. And this concept I just heard for the first time, I think actually it's from one of your colleagues. Aaron mentioned the idea of hardened communities. I hadn't heard that term. But, you know, the idea of not only individual buildings that won't burn and by extension, you know, be subject to hurricanes and that kind of thing, but also entire communities. You know, are we going to be able to get insurance for anything in Greenville, Indian Valley, Plymouth County?
Yeah.
North State.
Right. Well, they're already, right, you know, canceling people's insurance that aren't even near the fire. They're
right.
Just, you know,
so,
you're close
yeah.
enough. See ya.
So we're going to have to look at new, we're going to have to, I think, in some ways, get, you know, the major industry, and, you know, because I'm really connected to the concrete industry, it's the one where I work the most, but we're going to need data and proof and arguments, not only at the local level, but from private industry to help back it up, that we can rebuild. It's not going to be the historic wood gold rush town that it was, but you can rebuild with character and at the same time safely and with durability on an individual building level and a larger community level. But I think it's, and going right back to kind of our heartstrings, you know, there are a few buildings in Greenville where some of the walls are standing. And, you know, let's make sure those walls stay standing, and then we can get some creative people in there and work around them. But there's got to be that sense of connection.
Well, they're making concrete siding and concrete fencing.
Oh.
And, I mean, they make all kinds
well,
of stuff.
Well, think
concrete.
Of, Mike Bobbin. He's a local concrete contractor, and he was
concrete's a fun material. Right.
It was a long time ago. He was making fences out of it. Like, they look like wood split rail fences, but they're made out of concrete.
There were concrete ships made.
Oh yeah,
really?
Yeah,
that's right.
It's a fun material because if you think about it, you know, it's a complicated material to work with because think of it as a durable product, or I'm sorry, a perishable product. You know, mm-hmm. if you put concrete in the back of a concrete truck, you know, you've got to get it point A to point B before it starts turning, hardening. But something like, okay, let's take again, I'm going to keep coming back to Greenville because that's so, it's just so moving and it's so a part of everybody's lives right now. You know, you can, and there's a lot of unreinforced historic buildings all around our area, across the country, the world. You can go in and you can do, and this is where, you know, historic preservation doesn't limit. It actually, if it's done right and people can talk about it in the right way, you can mix old with new. You can go in and put a steel frame on the inside and shotcrete the walls from the inside and maintain that historic character, which makes people still feel that it's their community, but now it's safe. It's going to withstand.
And does that,
so
you can do that and it doesn't screw up the historicalness, you know?
There, you know, no. There will be somebody out there who would challenge me on that. I'm happy to argue, make that argument. Absolutely not. Historic preservation doesn't mean standing something still in time by any means.
Since
nothing actually does stand
still in time and things decay.
No. Forests don't. Buildings don't. Communities don't. There are specific areas of historic preservation, the term restoration being one of them, which is, yes, we're going to hold this particular building in time because it has such significance, like Mount Vernon, right? George mm-hmm. Washington's house.
Yeah.
It still looks that way. But no, when you talk about rehabilitation or all these other things within the kind of historic preservation realm, that allows for current uses, creative solutions. It's just getting ahead of it in the right way and being able to use the right term. But for a town like Greenville, if everything is bulldozed up there, and that's, some of us are a little worried about that, you know, we want to make sure that we're aware of the process of how this is going to go down. If all of that is bulldozed and nothing is saved, there's no evidence, you know, what's the new character of that town going to be?
I'm thinking Dollar General.
Yeah. The dollar store survived.
I mean, you look at our, honestly, you look at a lot of our towns that had downtowns. And then they all turned into just kind of like blah, strip mall, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No character.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty cool idea that you could go in and actually set a town up, you know, set up a series of buildings for the long term without changing the way they look.
Yeah.
On the outside.
And those become the anchor that, you know, your grandfather can say, I bought my, you know, fishing rod there. You know, those are the anchors in the character and the connection to the past. And some new things can go in right next door, but it's the continuity and the change over time that still it's looking backward and looking forward all at the same time. And we can't just do one or the other. But unfortunately, you know, higher level politicians want a good, clean, single direction.
Right.
And this is messy stuff. It's just messy, 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 and it's going to continue to be messy.
And I think that's a argument in most towns. When new development comes in, I mean, do we tear down the old or do we, you know, restore it?
Well, or do you just say, oh, well, it was a period of time that's now over. So all of you people now just go live someplace else.
Well, in rural England, you can't tear a building down. You have to rebuild it. Their building codes over there are like, I mean, they still have houses with thatched roofs. Because you can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of funny. Like in Connecticut, I just was looking on Zillow because I was looking up a couple of places where we used to live when we were kids. So I looked our house up in Connecticut. I kid you not, it's still white with black shutters. It's like it'll be white with black shutters forever because they change nothing. If you start tearing things down, that is considered that actually is considered just socially unacceptable. They resist that in the East. I'm surprised you live in the West.
There's a lot of proof for economic development based on historic preservation. You know, it's a bad name as, oh, we just if it's historic, we can't do anything. Well, you know, I choose to see historic preservation as economic development, and you know, kind of seem very foo-foo here, but it's the human connection.
True. People love to go to places like that. And you love it when you drive into a town. Look at all those towns on along 395 and in through that gold rush area, and you pull into those towns, and it's like, I mean, it's not like going back in time in a bad way. It's cool.
Right. Yeah.
But even in Greenville, it's essentially that the town is gone, but there's a few buildings, the old sheriff's office, the what used to be called the way station. In my childhood, it was called the Copper Hood.
Is that the building on the corner? You said
that one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, if we can all band together up there and really convince the county supervisors to let us speak, be a part of the process, save enough of the heart and soul, and think responsibly about what comes in next, there's a new character and a new life for that town. And it doesn't necessarily have to be all managed and organized from the top down.
Yep. And it doesn't have to look like
it has to be economically viable. It's all those things, but you know, it just can't be managed from a long way away by people who don't have a connection.
Right, right. Because it'll never end up the way you want. You're right. You have to manage it locally.
Yeah. I just think it's very, very cool that you guys are doing this and providing jobs with our veterans and just making all of that. Kind of come together in one place. It's impressive. You also, I was looking here, you're a nonprofit 501c3 foundation and you, take on sponsors to support programs and,
absolutely
funding partners and all that. I really hope people spread this around since I didn't know there was something like this out there and available. And, it's something that will benefit all of our communities, whether we live in a big place or a small place, but especially those of us who really have a heart for the small places.
And if you, you know, if you continue on following on our website, we're actually working with Congress to get this, not that I want it to go necessarily a political route, but we're trying to get as many people on board to get this into many more national parks across the U.S. So the opportunity is bigger and more available to more service members, and it improves our parks.
That is
spectacular. For everybody who uses them, and the output is workforce to fix our infrastructure.
Thank you so much. Tanya Wattenberg-Comas. She is with the CPI Foundation, so it's cpi-foundation.org. And thank you so much for coming on with us today, and we're all smarter for it.
Yeah. Great
well,
show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank
you. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.